From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Parents in Montpelier are upset because the police photographed their kids who walked out of school to protest the war. And police said that they're going to hand over those photos to the school authorities so that the kids can be dealt with.
Police, protests, and photos. The Vermont police asked journalists to turn over photographs of student protesters for police fires, for police files. And is another mass deportation of Pakistanis imminent? We'll find out. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. France and Russia declared yesterday they would veto a U.S.-backed draft resolution setting a March 17th deadline for Iraq to disarm or face war. The BBC reports the U.S. may now delay a vote in the U.N. Security Council. President Jacques Chirac said he was convinced that the U.N. inspections process was working and that Iraq could be stripped of its weapons without war. And U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan warned at a news conference at The Hague that U.S. unilateral action against Iraq would be a violation of the U.N. Charter. Annan said, quote, "The Charter is very clear on the circumstance under which force can be used. If the United States and others were to go outside the Council to take military action, it would not be in conformity with the Charter. One compromise by Britain would add a series of goals or benchmarks to the draft resolution that Iraq must meet in order to prove it is really disarming. It would also extend the deadline beyond March 17th. Humanitarian aid workers planning to help the possible flood of people displaced by a war on Iraq are saying they still didn't have the funds they needed to save lives in the event war breaks out. The World Food Program has requested $23 million to deal with the anticipated crisis, but so far it's received less than a third of that. For the second time in a month, a veteran U.S. diplomat has resigned in protest over U.S. policy toward Iraq. 22-year State Department veteran John Brown wrote, "I cannot in good conscience support President Bush's war plans against Iraq. Throughout the globe, the United States is becoming associated with the unjustified use of force." The letter went on to say, "The president's disregard for views in other nations, borne out by his neglect of public diplomacy, is giving birth to an anti-American century." Iranian officials yesterday maintained it is not developing nuclear weapons, but argued that Iran does have the right to possess such weapons, in part to balance Israel's nuclear arsenal. The International Atomic Energy Agency recently discovered Iran's nuclear program to be far more advanced than previously believed. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 vote, ruled yesterday workers who become ill from exposure to toxic substances on the job may seek damages to pay for fear they will someday develop cancer, even if they never do get the disease. The court's ruling came in a case involving railroad workers afflicted with a lung disease called asbestosis, who are fearful about developing cancer. Industry and insurance groups had attempted to persuade the Supreme Court to limit employers' liability for damages from asbestos. Developers of oil and gas sites across the country will have at least 2 more years before they're required to get new storm water permits intended to protect fish, wildlife, and people. The Environmental Protection Agency has postponed the implementation of the new regulations, which were to go into effect this week. The Palestinian parliament yesterday approved the creation of a prime minister seat, but vested the new position with only limited powers. The parliament is soon expected to back the appointment of Mahmoud Abbas. The Palestinian legislators approved a bill defining the prime minister's powers as dealing largely with internal affairs, including naming and supervising cabinet ministers. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan announced yesterday that months of intense talks between leaders of the Greek and Turkish factions to unify Cyprus have ended in failure. Federal regulators yesterday blocked a proposal by utility companies to store high-level nuclear waste on an Indian reservation in Utah's western desert, citing dangers posed by a nearby Air Force training range. The Senate appears set to ban certain late-term abortions that have been debated in the Senate since 1995. The current bill provides an exemption from the ban in cases where the procedure is necessary to save a woman's life, but it does not provide an exemption to protect her health. The San Francisco Chronicle reports library patrons in Santa Cruz, California, are now being warned that records of the books they borrow may wind up in the hands of federal agents. Last week, the city posted warnings in 10 branches. The signs note that the USA Patriot Act, quote, prohibits library workers from informing you if federal agents have obtained records about you. And patrons are told, quote, questions about this policy should be directed to Attorney General John Ashcroft, Department of Justice, Washington, D.C., 20530. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As intense negotiations go on behind the scenes at the UN Security Council, protesters around the country are also organizing against war. Ted Glick is on the line with us right now. He is an organizer for the umbrella group United for Peace and Justice. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy. Good to be on.
It's good to have you. Can you talk about the various plans that are taking place as most of the media focuses on what's going on the diplomatic front? What's going on the protest front?
Well, just this past Sunday, 2 days ago, United for Peace and Justice had a national meeting here in Washington. We had representatives from over 100 organizations from all over the country. And we unanimously adopted an emergency plan to move to try to stop this war. We think that we cannot accept that this war, this full-scale war, is going to happen, and we need to step up our actions. We are calling upon people this week, starting today, to again flood Congress, congressional offices with emails, faxes, phone calls. Maybe go visit your congressional offices this week, maybe particularly on Thursday. But that as a build-up then to next week, when beginning on March 17th, on Monday, we are calling upon people to come to Washington, D.C., come for the march on March 15th, the march on the White House that's being organized, and stay over and take part in nonviolent direct action at the Capitol. We need to reclaim the Capitol. We need to claim our democracy. A majority of the people of this country are against this drive towards unilateral war. Monday will be a kickoff of a day-after-day campaign next week where we need, both in Washington and around the country at congressional offices, we need to ratchet up the pressure and nonviolently make it clear that we do not accept this war drive. We think that this could be a very critical piece of the work that we have been doing and that could make it possible that we can stop this war. We need people to see this as important and to get involved with it.
And what exactly are you going to be doing?
Well, we're in the process of pulling all the plans together. There's no question that people are going to be visiting the offices of congresspeople on Monday, the 17th, here in D.C. And what we are demanding is that they repeal this supposed authorization for war that was passed last fall, and that there needs to be a vote by the Congress on war. Congress has abdicated its responsibilities, and we need to demand that they take up their responsibilities and not allow war to take place. People will go into those offices, and people, we expect, will not leave voluntarily until such action is taken on the part of the Congress people who they are talking with. We also will be taking action outside, being visible with our demand that Congress takes action. We're in the process right now. This is very much an emergency campaign because it is an emergency. So we're in the process of putting together all the specifics. What's important is for people to get here on Saturday. At the latest Sunday morning, there will be spokes council meetings. There will be nonviolence training. We're setting up the logistics. There will be opportunities for people to participate in shaping what we do.
Well, Ted Glick, I want to thank you very much for being with us, organizer for United for Peace and Justice. Where can people go on the web or make contact with your group?
United for Peace and Justice's website is www.unitedforpeace.org.
Thank you very much.
And you could call the national office at 212-603-3700.
Thank you. Ted Glick with United for Peace and Justice. Well, another mass deportation of Pakistani detainees is imminent. This according to the Brooklyn-based immigrant rights group Coney Island Avenue Project. There have been three other mass deportations so far. In November, 87 Pakistanis were deported from Buffalo, New York. 95 were deported in August. 131 deported in June. The secret mass deportations have taken place in the middle of the night when family members and immigrant rights activists are unable to be at the detention centers to help the detainees. Families have been ripped apart by the deportations. Witnesses who insisted on anonymity told United Press International in August that many of the deportees were married to U.S. citizens. They were forced to leave their spouses and children behind. Very few newspapers have picked up the story. We're joined right now by Bobby Khan, who's director of the Coney Island Avenue Project. Welcome to Democracy Now! So what is happening in this case?
Yesterday, in early morning, about 4 o'clock, though one day before, the inmates in Hudson County Detention Center were told that...
This is in New Jersey?
New Jersey. That whatever their luggages are going to go with them, they should be delivered to the deportation office not later than Monday till 11, which meant that they are going to be deported either Monday night or Tuesday evening.
Which is tonight?
Yeah. But ironically, a lot of family members went there for their luggages to give it to the deportation office to go with them, and they were told that they have already deported them. They have already transferred them from Hudson to some unidentified place, which we assume is Buffalo, and they have already gathered a lot of people over there to be deported, you know, in the same plane. So all the family members were very upset. They were not allowed to make calls, especially on the Sunday night and Sunday evening, so just to say hello to their loved ones and family members.
Do you know who some of these men are who are being sent away?
Yes. Like you mentioned that they had families over here. I was talking to one family woman last night. When she was told that her husband has been deported, she's expecting any day, and she started crying that she has fear that the fear of war in Pakistan, especially, you know, after Iraq, there a lot of Pakistanis are afraid that they might go after Pakistan, the Bush administration, and she never know that whether he'll be able to see his daughter and who she's going to bond, and she was very upset. And another family, she just recently delivered the baby a few days ago. Her baby has kidney problem by birth, so she's also looking for help of her husband, and you know, she wanted him to be close. They requested the courts but their requests were never accepted, and these people are deported. You know,
We have been covering this on a regular basis. What kind of access do the detainees have to lawyers?
These detainees have no rights. They have. They are given no attorneys, no lawyers, except we voluntarily working. We are working with the detainees and some other groups. So we go and find out that if there is need. But there are a lot of people those they don't know. I mean, and they don't have any access to the lawyers. And a lot of them, their due processes are still there. Three of them we applied motion to stay and they were granted out of this mass deportation, and they were offloaded from the plane. But still, we think that there were a lot those they had rights to appeal. They had rights to.
What do you mean that they don't have rights?
This is according to the immigration laws when. They are arresting them in the dragnet of 9/11, and people those they have deportation orders. Though based on those orders, they don't know what happened with them like 10-15 years back when they came here, and they have been given deportation orders, and according to them, they have no rights to go before the judge, and they have no rights to have an attorney or anything, you know.
Are Pakistanis the number one target when it comes to mass deportations?
Right.
Is it the only country that people have been deported en masse to?
No, there are other Muslim countries too. But the vast majority is Pakistanis. There are other Middle Eastern countries as well, Jordan, Egypt, and...
In terms of the numbers that have been sent?
Uh-huh.
Yet we hear very little about this.
Uh-huh.
Why?
Because there's no proper advocacy for them, I believe. And vast majority is the Pakistanis. So I mean that's one reason that some people are working and there is a proper not very proper but some advocacy for this community.
What's the airline that is being used to deport them?
You don't know. We never know. They might use the army plane. They might use the any airline plane or anything.
What is Yes Airlines?
Which one?
You don't know what the name?
No.
It's a private airline?
Yes. Sometime private, sometime it was even the army plane as well, you know.
Is there an airline called Yes Airlines? Yes? According to UPI, there's a company called Yes Airlines that's hired to carry the deportees.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Perhaps.
Now... Do you know at this point how many men, Arabs, Muslims, South Asians, have been rounded up and detained? The Justice Department has admitted, some 1,200?
Which is absolutely a big-time lie. They have rounded up about 10,000 people, out of which just 5,000 to 6,000 are just Pakistanis.
Really?
Yeah.
How many in the community you work in Brooklyn, would you say are being picked up a week?
On average, about 5 to 6 a week are being picked up.
5 to 6 Pakistani
Pakistanis
men a week.
Yeah.
So that doesn't include everyone else.
No. 5 to 6, and this is just, I'm talking about the Brooklyn, you know.
What are you asking people to do? What do you think can be done in this situation?
We want people to speak up. We want people to come out, and we want people to speak up about their rights and protest what is going on. It is clearly a discrimination. It's clearly a racial profiling, and we want people to come out and speak about this discrimination and. and the hardship they are facing. And also we ask, you know, the legislators to amend these laws, to roll back these laws. Those are affecting the families. Like I told you that, I mean, these are pregnant women and U.S. citizen wives. Those are, I mean, being separated from their husbands and spouses. So, I mean, they should think about it and they should give them chance to live with them. You
know. Bobby Khan is director of the Coney Island Avenue Project, longtime Pakistani immigrant rights advocate. If people want to get in touch with the Coney Island Avenue Project, where can they go? On the web or phone number?
Yeah, our contact information is 718-859-0238 and my cell number is 917-440-9002.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Mi esposa, my wife, worked on the 80th floor. The company had hired illegals before. She got the job by word of mouth. That's the way in the north when you're from the south. They say 3,000, but the counting's not done. Mi esposa está muerta. 3,001. I have no favors, I have no rights. All my days in sleepless nights. Come after me, mi hermano, my brother, the elevator man, a doctor in our country, but you take what you can. I saw the photos in Union Square, but I could not leave his picture there. You say 3,000, but that's not true. Mi hermano no volverá. 3,000.
If I say your name here on Democracy Now!, Pat Humphreys and Sandy Opitow, you are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, over 60 students walked out of classes in Montpelier, the state capital of Vermont. As part of an international student strike, they marched through downtown to the steps of the State House. After a couple of failed attempts, they were allowed in for a personal meeting with the governor. Then they continued the protest downtown. The event made local headlines on Democracy Now! We talked to one of the students, but we've since learned it was not just the press that was keeping a close eye on the student protesters, so were the Montpelier police. According to the Rutland Herald, the police took photographs of the students that are to be kept in department files. One local police officer even asked a local news photographer for copies of the photographs he'd taken. The officer reportedly told the news photographer, quote, make sure you get close-ups of their faces in case they need to be suspended. The American Civil Liberties Union says the police should not be collecting information of citizens who are exercising their First Amendment rights. Ironically, on the day before the protest, voters ratified a city council resolution condemning the USA Patriot Act. The resolution directs the local police to, quote, uphold its policy of respecting and protecting the freedoms of speech, religions, and assembly and privacy. We're joined right now by one of the students who organized the protest at Montpelier High School, as well as her principal. And we'll start with Aria Allen. She is in 10th grade. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. So can you tell us what happened on your day of protest?
Yes. Well, like you said, it began, we just walked out, and we went to the State House, and I was one of the ones up in front of the march, so I could see the policeman. And not only did he have, I saw him actually go over to the reporter and talk to him, and then the reporter just kind of nodded his head, and then the policeman kind of walked away. And the policeman, I only saw one policeman with a digital camera who was taking pictures of us, And at the time, I didn't think much of it just because I wasn't thinking about that. And so, but then I woke up a couple mornings after that to a 7:30 phone call saying that there's a huge thing going on because the policemen still have our photos. And then I realized that that's what they were doing. And then I read the newspapers, and it said that the reason why they took the photos was because just in case of vandalism. But now that everything's over and there was no vandalism, why are they still keeping the photos? And the reporter actually said that the policeman said, like you said, close-ups of their face in case they need to be suspended. Well, first of all, we weren't going to be suspended. And second of all, why do we need the photos in the first place? Our principal knew who was gone. He saw us, like, leave the building. So it wasn't even right, really, to take the photos in the first place.
We are joined by the Montpelier Police Chief, Douglas Hoyt. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what the police department is asking for of the news photographers, but also whether the police are keeping the students' photos on file?
I'm sorry. I understand the second part of your question, but the first part of your question?
Well, the first part had to do with the piece in the Rutland Herald that said that not only did the police take photographs of the students, but that one local police officer asked a news photographer for copies of the photographs that he was taking and said, quote, make sure you get close-ups of their faces in case they need to be suspended.
I do believe that there was some discussion between local news photographer and one of the officers. But I also know that, after the event, a day or so afterwards, the photographer talked to the officer and indicated he didn't feel comfortable with sharing any photos. And quite candidly, I agree with him. It would be highly unusual for the news media to willingly share, the products of their work with the police or anybody else for that matter. And there was no need for us to make him feel uncomfortable, and we indicated that we had no need for his pictures and appreciated his time, and that was the end of that.
Chief Douglas Hoyt, what about the photos of students like Aria Allen, the 10th grader, who was one of the organizers of the protests that the police themselves took? Are you keeping them in the files?
Are we keeping them? I think in the final analysis, we probably won't be keeping them. And in terms of the files, I'm not. That has, some implications and undertones that something else is going on, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Mm-hmm. We're also joined on the phone by Joseph Gainza, who is the program coordinator for the Vermont Office of the American Friends Service Committee, and want to welcome WGDR to the air because Joseph Gainza has a program right now, and so we're broadcasting both on Democracy Now! Around the country and locally in Plainfield, Vermont, in the Montpelier area in Vermont. Joseph Gainza, can you talk about your concerns now?
We do have certainly a concern about the fact that students exercising their First Amendment rights would be photographed. I know it's not the intention of Chief Hoyt to chill people's desire to participate in democracy and to exercise their First Amendment rights, but an unintended consequence of that could very well be that some students in the future will be more reluctant to step forward and express their concerns about issues that are confronting their community as well as the nation. So, we have a big concern that the photographs would be taken in the first place. I'm glad to hear that Commissioner Hoyt is not going to be holding on to the photographs and will destroy them. That's good, but I hope that the police will announce that they won't be taking photographs of people exercising their First Amendment rights in the future.
Commissioner Hoyt, do you think that will be the case? Could you make that announcement?
Well, I appreciate the promotion, but I'm not commissioner.
Oh, excuse me, Doug.
That's okay, Joe. Good to hear your voice this morning.
Thank you. Same here.
And I appreciate your comments. As you're well aware, and most of the people in the community are well aware, I think in the 23 years that I've been chief, one of the things that we stand for is to make sure that people do have the right to exercise those constitutional rights within the city of Montpelier, and do everything we can to make sure that that happens both safely for the pros and the counters, depending on whatever the issue is at the time.
I do have to say that that's true. We've had nothing but cooperation from the Montpelier police in the demonstrations and rallies we've had in the city. This is a real concern because it seems like we're sliding into a behavior that is counter to everything that the Montpelier Police Department has promoted in the past.
Well, you know, it's not important for me to engage in discussion in terms of which side of any issue a person sits on. But Joe, and the listeners, if you stop and think of some of the groups that have come to Montpelier who have been especially troublesome in terms of the message that they're trying to deliver, as an example, the Westboro Baptist Church of Kansas, who brought a very vociferous, bigoted, hate-mongering campaign against the gay community. There was a anti-abortion group, a pro-life group that came to Montpelier not too long ago that brought some extremely outrageous photographs of fetuses and had an in-your-face campaign, and were, again, also borderline violent. I think it's important for the law enforcement agency to take pictures in those agencies to make sure that their conduct in exercising those rights are well within the borders of following all applicable laws. And I think it's important to collect that information, even in a normal protest, if you will. And the issue then there seems to be, even if they're taken, what is done with them afterwards? And I suspect I see where people are at in terms of the retention of those things, the photographs. So I think the decision will be made to continue to take the photographs where it's appropriate, but to not retain them unless, of course, there's some sort of criminal conduct.
So,
if I'm making myself clear.
So, Chief Hoyt, will the pictures now be destroyed that are in the file?
I believe they will be, yes.
Mm-hmm. I think we also have Aria Allen's school principal on the line, the principal of Montpelier High School, Peter Evans. Are you with us?
Okay, hold on. I might have to get
okay, it. They're sharing one line in the principal's office.
Well, we could have all stayed right here in Montpelier.
Except that we're in New York.
Yeah.
And I think each one of these stories is definitely a national story. And I'm wondering, as we get Peter Evans on the line, Joseph Gainza, since we're also broadcasting on WGDR simultaneously as we do this national broadcast, if your scheduled guest for this half hour, the person who is behind the USA Patriot Act City Council resolution, is also on the line.
She's not on the line now, but we can call her now and get her on.
Yeah, that would be great, because
okay.
This directly relates to what we're talking about, as the resolution directs the local police to, quote, uphold its policy of respecting and protecting the freedoms of speech, religions, and assembly, and privacy. This is a part of a wave of resolutions around the country that is being passed, both anti-war and anti-U.S. Patriot Act. Peter Evans, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Hi, principal of Montpelier High School. Can you talk about your concerns about the photographs having been taken of the students? And you adopted a very different approach to the students who walked out last week than, for example, the principal of Rutland High School in Vermont, where several of the students were suspended for walking out.
Well, we I got a call from the organizers over our winter break, and I came in and met with them, and they laid out their plans for a walkout and kind of filled me in on the details of what they wanted to accomplish. They were very upfront about saying that they realized there would be some consequences. And we talked pretty openly about what the day was going to look like and what what they were willing to accept for consequences as part of their commitment to this cause. So our consequences were right from our student handbook, and they didn't involve suspensions. They were more in keeping with the students making up the time that they missed from the school, and some consequences for walking off school property without prior permission. But those have been dealt with, and the kids have accepted the responsibilities for those in a pretty amazing way. I've been really impressed with the students.
What about this issue of the photographs, taken by both the police and then the discussion that one of the police officers had with the news reporter asking for their photograph, for the photographs they were taking, and could they make them close up so they'd have a better picture of their faces?
Yeah, I got a call on Wednesday afternoon from the reporter for our local paper, and he asked if we were in need of photographs of the students in order to identify the kids who were involved. And I was kind of surprised because we knew who the kids were. We had a list of the students involved, and it were a pretty small school, under 500 students, and we know our students pretty well. And so we didn't need the photographs, but apparently he was asked by one of the local police officers to photograph each one of the students. And I just explained to him that that wasn't anything that we were in need of or that I thought was necessary.
Wait, let me clarify. The news photographer offered you the pictures?
No, the news photographer called me and asked me if that was something that we were in need of. And apparently, and again, local police department hasn't talked to me, so I don't know exactly what they were thinking, but the news photographer told me that one of the police officers had asked him to do some of the photographs because he thought we would need them in order to identify the students.
And was he offering them to you?
He wasn't offering them to me. He just wondered if that was something we needed, and so I guess maybe he was offering them to me, but I told him no, that that wasn't anything that we required. Again, we knew who the kids were, and we already had a record of our students.
Would you say, Chief Hoyt, that it was a mistake, the local officer's request to the journalist, the photographer?
No, I don't think it was a mistake. I think the, as I understand it, I wasn't present at the time, but what my officers are telling me, what the school resource officer is telling me, that the one of the officers who was speaking with the news photographer, his camera ended up full. There were some reports, and we can't substantiate them, but there were reports nonetheless from citizens that some of the students were walking on top of cars and hitting cars as they were coming down the street. And having any evidence of that and the persons who were involved in that is, I think that's an appropriate police response to those kind of complaints.
Peter Evans, let me go beyond the question of what is happening here with the police. Actually, my brother David Goodman, who's a reporter in Vermont, wrote a piece in Mother Jones Magazine called No Child Left Unrecruited, which is about the practice now of recruiters to ask schools for their entire roster, the names and addresses of students, and that principals are now handing over for fear of losing federal aid. Have you handed over the names and addresses of all of your students under the new No Child Left Behind Act?
Yes, we have. That was something we decided we were going to comply with as a district. There really wasn't any discussion at our district level about whether or not we would or wouldn't comply. We decided early on that we would. But we did, or I did, over the summer, in a mailing I did to parents, inform them of this change in protocols, and we asked parents, as the law provides or as the provision provides, we asked parents to notify us if they did not want their child's name to be included in that mailing. And we did receive probably a dozen or so requests from parents to pull their child's name off our off our roster. But we did release the rosters to some of the recruiters as they requested them.
Excuse me, Peter. The law also states that students themselves can request that their names be submitted.
That's right. And I'm sorry, I didn't mention that. We did have some students who also asked that their names not be released, mm-hmm. and we made that pretty clear in the letter that went home over the summer that either students or parents could request that. And altogether, parent and student requests, we had about a dozen.
I think this is something that most people in this country do not realize is happening, that mm-hmm. schools are now handing over wholesale the names of their students to the military, and that they have the option to opt out just by saying no, but it has to be proactive. The parents or the student themselves have to call. I'm wondering if you have considered Peter Evans, or if you have colleagues who are principals around the country who have said no themselves, that they will not hand over those lists.
I'm not aware of any principals who have not released the rosters. I'm Vermont's a pretty small state, and I'm involved with our principals group, and there hasn't been very much discussion about this, and as far as I know, I haven't, I'm not aware of any principal who's held off handing those out. The law also extends to colleges and higher ed, so that was another kind of change for us. And we did notify parents that any colleges or postgraduate institutions that wanted those rosters, they would also be eligible to receive them. And parents had the right to pull their names, their child's names off those as well.
Is Aria Allen still there? Is she gone off to class?
Yes, she's here.
Aria Allen, the 10th grade student who organized the student strike at Montpelier High School. Aria, are you with us?
Here she is.
Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you have a question for the police chief of Montpelier, Douglas Hoyt.
Well, they pretty much summed it up saying that they were going to get rid of the photos. And I guess that I just want to know if we do ever do this, something like this again, are we going to be photographed?
Chief Hoyt?
Yes.
The question of Aria Allen, the student organizer of the protest, if they ever do this kind of thing again, will they be photographed?
I can't respond with either a straight no or a straight yes. I guess that it sort of depends on what's occurring at the time. If there's the possibility that there is going to be some criminal conduct occurring during these events, we will probably photograph. And if at the end of the event there was not anything that occurred, then those photographs would be considered to be disposed.
I'd like to interject here.
This is Joseph Gaines of the American Friends Service Committee.
And let people know that this Wednesday evening at the Montpelier City Hall, the City Council will be discussing these issues, and I'd like to invite anyone who can to come to that meeting and express your concern about this. Perhaps what the City Council needs to be considering is to whether or not this policy should stand, considering the First Amendment implications of it.
Joseph Gaines,
we don't have a problem with that, Joe. In fact, Bill Frazier, the city manager, and I were speaking last week about this, and in terms of setting the agenda for the council meeting on the 12th, we asked to have that put on the agenda so that we could talk to our city council about that.
That's great.
We'd like to ask you all to stay for a moment. We break for 60 seconds of music, and we come back. We'll also be joined by Nathan Mittelstadt, who is a member of Students Against War at the University of Minnesota. An interesting situation happening there where an expert on counterterrorism identified his group alongside others like the Aryan Nations as a potential threat to the state of Minnesota and what that means. We also hope to have joining us on Joseph Gaines' show, which we're broadcasting now, on in Plainfield, Vermont, his guest, who is the organizer of the Anti-USA Patriot Act resolution that passed in the Montpelier City Council. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Step out in the night when you get lonely. Listen for the sounds the city ears don't hear. I know your cross is getting heavier with every step, but I know a man who walks miles for you. Stop, take a look at yourself, take a good look, take a good look.
Richie Havens, No Opportunity Necessary, No Experience Needed. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. We're in Vermont right now, looking at a local story with national implications, the issue of police monitoring of student protests, taking photographs, and where they will go from here. Our guests are the Montpelier Police Chief, Douglas Hoyt, Aria Allen, 10th grade student, who was one of the organizers of the Montpelier High School student strike last week, Joseph Gainza, program coordinator for the Vermont Office of the American Friends Service Committee, who is also a programmer at WGDR in Plainfield on the Goddard campus, and we are broadcasting live on that station right now on his program. We are also joined by Peter Evans, the principal of Montpelier High School. In Montpelier, the students were not suspended for protesting. In Rutland, Vermont, a group of them were suspended. We're also joined by Nathan Mittelstadt, who is a member of Students Against War at the University of Minnesota.
Ellen Kay, who is the organizer in Brattleboro and organized nine towns to pass a resolution opposing the Patriot Act, is also on the line.
And that is Ellen Kay.
Ellen Kay.
Good to have you with us, Ellen. Well, let's go for a minute to Nathan Mittelstadt. And Nathan, last week, an expert on counterterrorism identified your group, Students Against War, alongside other groups like the Aryan Nations, as a potential threat to the state of Minnesota. What does this mean?
I'd like to go over a little of the background of it. Last Tuesday, I got a call from the Star Tribune, and I'm used to getting, you know, calls about whatever local protest is coming up or, you know, what's your opinion on the war, stuff like that. But instead, I hear them say, you know, I was at this seminar today called Understanding Terrorism in Minnesota, and your group's name came up, along with the Rise Bookstore, which is a progressive bookstore in the Twin Cities, and anti-racist action as not exactly terrorist groups, but domestically identified groups which may affect our communities. And it was really kind of spooky because as was said before, we were identified with groups like Posse Comitatus, like Aryan Nation, like the Ku Klux Klan. And I guess since then we've been working together with the Rise Bookstore and Anti-Racist Action in particular to try and not only clear our names, but also to figure out, you know, who else is on these lists and what criteria are used to determine them. And on a larger scale, you know, is this constrained by, like, any sort of facts that they have to present? Because one of the things mentioned about our group was that we're planning on having a walkout the day after bombing starts. But what we're not planning on having and what hasn't even been discussed was a plan to move cars into the middle of intersections to block traffic. And so we're really, you know, curious as to, you know, where some of the grounds for listing us as extremist groups is coming from. And thankfully we've had people with the National Lawyer Skills who are going to help us try and find that out.
Ellen Kay is with us, the organizer of the Anti-USA Patriot Act bill in the City Council of Montpelier, Vermont. Can you talk about how this bill got passed and perhaps how it bears on both stories that we've been listening to, the kids walking out in Montpelier, Vermont, and maybe you can extend it to what Nathan has just described at the University of Minnesota?
Actually, let me clarify what I have done, which is that I live in Brattleboro, Vermont, and I worked down in this part of the state, which is the southeastern corner. Montpelier actually did their action a little bit independently of ours. What we did was to go to the Brattleboro Select Board in early February and get a resolution passed there against the abuses of the USA Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act and other federal executive orders. Then we proceeded for the next month to organize in 9 different towns down here, and on town meeting day, all of those 9 towns passed local resolutions in their towns about the USA Patriot Act. We now have, with Montpelier and Burlington and a few other towns further north of here, we now have 16 localities in Vermont that have acted on these resolutions and passed them. Unfortunately, I couldn't hear the student from Minnesota very well. I think I understand the gist of what he said, though. And what we're looking at with these resolutions is the general erosion of our freedom to speech, our freedom of assembly, our freedom of expression, and especially political expression. That this is kind of the domestic component of the war. This is the war at home against us and against dissidents and against people of varying ethnicities.
Police Chief Douglas Hoyt, does this passage of the Anti-USA Patriot Act in your city council, Montpelier City Council, affect what you do?
No, I don't think it does at all.
Your response to that, Ellen Kay?
Well, hopefully that's good. What we were trying to do in these resolutions is to clarify to the police, part of what these resolutions do, hope to do, is to clarify to our local police their role in our communities, that we're reminding them and helping them to understand that their roles have not been changed and they should not see their powers as enhanced by these acts, that they still should be doing community policing, upholding our Bill of Rights, upholding Bill of Rights provisions as they were trained to do in police academies. So we're actually using this as a clarifying tool. We're saying, yeah, their job shouldn't be different. They shouldn't be rounding people up. They shouldn't be spying on citizens and activists and dissidents. They shouldn't be detaining people without due process. And so that's what we're actually not asking them to do anything illegal. However, these acts, especially the USA Patriot Act, puts us in the position of having to choose between basically which law we're going to violate. Are we going to violate the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, which has been around for 200 plus years, or are we going to be in violation of the USA Patriot Act, which is a new and quite radical step backward? So there really is no middle ground here. We're asking the police to continue doing what they're trained to do and nothing more.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Ellen Kay, the organizer of the Anti-USA Patriot Act City Council resolution in Montpelier that did pass, Police Chief Douglas Hoyt of the Montpelier Police, Aria Allen and her principal, Peter Evans of Montpelier High School, and Joseph Gainza, who is the program coordinator of the Vermont Office American Friends Service Committee, and also WGDR. May community radio live on as we broadcast simultaneously on Joseph Gaines's program on WGDR and on Democracy Now! Around the country. Joseph, your show can decide whether or not to remain with us as we go to our last guest, who is Daniel Ellsberg, who is just on the line with us from Washington, D.C. Yesterday on Democracy Now! We reported that a 28-year-old woman working at the top-secret British government communications headquarters has been arrested on charges of contravening the Official Secrets Act, the electronic surveillance arm of the British Intelligence Service. The arrest comes just a few days after the London Observer published a top-secret National Security Agency document. The memo revealed U.S. agents had been ordered to bug the telephone, home and office, and email communications of of UN Security Council diplomats from Angola, Cameroon, Chile, Bulgaria, Guinea, and Pakistan. The surveillance operation was designed to help the U.S. win votes for the war resolution on Iraq. The Observer reports that the NSA document was leaked to the paper by British security sources who objected to aiding the U.S. surveillance operation. Well, we're joined right now by the most famous whistleblower in U.S. history, who Henry Kissinger described as the world's most dangerous man. He is Daniel Ellsberg. During the Cold War, Daniel Ellsberg was a U.S. Marine Company commander. He's a Pentagon official and analyst at the RAND Corporation. In October 1969, he began smuggling out of his office and photocopying a 7,000-page top-secret study of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam, which later became known as the Pentagon Papers. By leaking the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg set in motion actions that would eventually topple the Nixon presidency and end the Vietnam War. Daniel Ellsberg, you're going to hold a news conference today about the arrest of this 28-year-old woman in British intelligence. How significant is it?
I think what's most significant is the information that she delivered, assuming that, giving her credit now, that the British have confirmed the authenticity of her revelation, and I'm assuming that they have the right person, and there may be other persons involved as well, but all of this is speculation. I haven't seen much news on it here at all. More significantly, I haven't seen news in the New York Times, the paper of record, or most other papers at all of the fact that there was such a revelation, which tells us something. I'm not quite sure what about American press at this point, that they don't regard as newsworthy something that's headline news in Britain and all over the world outside the U.S. I think the one major significance, and there are several, I think, of this particular leak, which I think the authenticity of which has now been significantly supported and which I found very plausible anyway, that the Americans were conducting a campaign to bug the phones, even the home phones, of all the UN security members and many others in order to get information, but also, I think, to get information with which to bribe, intimidate, find the vulnerabilities of, and basically manipulate other members of the Security Council. Several fold. First, that any supposed consensus that emerges, a vote in favor of this war from the Security Council has to be regarded as very suspect, as having essentially been coerced. And the significance of that is that President Bush is relying, and Britain and others genuinely supporting the war, and by Britain I mean the British Prime Minister, not the British public, which is in great disagreement with the policy, that the legitimacy of their effort against Iraq is supposedly based on an authorization from the Security Council, which is now very much in question, and having been a coalition of the coerced, a coalition of the bugged, bribed, intimidated, and having essentially no legitimacy at all, which is to say that a resulting invasion will be a crime against the peace, aggressive war of the kind that Saddam himself conducted a dozen years ago against Kuwait. It will have no more legitimacy than that. And that means that all deaths on all sides in that war will be unjustified. And I think this will be homicide, will be murder, something rightfully resisted by people in all countries. I think the second point is that the very fact of this very high-level leak by a very specialized and trusted member of the intelligence community, and that would be true of all the people in the agency where she works, represents a very great disagreement with the policy among, in a sense, that is not in Britain's best interest, or one would guess in their sister democracy in the Americas, or the other Commonwealth countries that are engaged in this bugging operation. Great feeling of resistance to the policy in the very institutions that are meant to provide the information base for it, the intelligence base for it. In other words, a sense that the reasons being given for the conflict by their political
Daniel Ellsberg,
are unfounded.
Thank you very much for joining us. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Okay. Thanks for listening.
Thanks a lot.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
So when I first got a date, I thought they were going to execute me. And I thought it was over, so I was pushing everybody away, you know, figuring that if they weren't so close to me, it wouldn't hurt as much. Wouldn't write nobody. Just trying to get everybody out of my life, thinking in my twisted mind that the further away from me, you know, the less it'll hurt.
Delma Banks is about to become the 300th person executed in Texas since the resumption of capital punishment in 1982. He is scheduled to die 6 p.m. Texas time on Wednesday. We'll hear about his case. But first, a debate on torture.
No country that calls itself civilized should engage in torture. Yet the United States is routinely torturing 9/11 suspected terrorists. Recently, two men were killed, apparently as a result of beatings sustained during such torture.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the second time in a month, a veteran U.S. diplomat has resigned in protest over U.S. policy toward Iraq. In his resignation letter, 22-year State Department veteran John Brown wrote, "I cannot in good conscience support President Bush's war plans against Iraq. Throughout the globe, the United States is becoming associated with the unjustified use of force." The letter goes on to say, "The president's disregard for views in other nations, borne out by his neglect of public diplomacy, is giving birth to an anti-American century." Unquote. France and Russia declared yesterday they would veto a U.S.-backed draft resolution setting a March 17th deadline for Iraq to disarm or face war. The BBC reports the U.S. may now delay a vote in the U.N. Security Council. President Jacques Chirac said he was convinced the U.N. inspections process is working and that Iraq could be stripped of its weapons without war. And UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said at a news conference at The Hague that U.S. unilateral action against Iraq would be a violation of the UN Charter. British Prime Minister Tony Blair warned France and Russia that pledging to veto a second resolution on Iraq would let Saddam Hussein off the hook. Britain is considering putting forth a compromise resolution that would create a series of goals or benchmarks to the draft resolution that Iraq must meet in order to prove it is really disarming. It would also extend the deadline beyond March 17th. Meanwhile, Pakistan is expected to announce today it will abstain from voting on a second UN resolution that would authorize war against Iraq. Humanitarian aid workers planning to help the possible flood of people displaced by a war in Iraq are saying they still don't have the funds they need to save lives in the event war breaks out. The World Food Program has requested $23 million to deal with the anticipated crisis, but so far it's received less than a third of that. Iranian officials yesterday maintained Iran is not developing nuclear weapons, but argued it does have the right to possess such weapons, in part to balance Israel's nuclear arsenal. The International Atomic Energy Agency recently discovered Iran's nuclear program to be far more advanced than previously believed. The Palestinian parliament yesterday approved the creation of a prime minister seat, but vested the new position with only limited powers. The parliament is soon expected to back the appointment of Mahmoud Abbas. Palestinian legislators approved a bill defining the prime minister's powers as dealing largely with internal affairs, including naming and supervising cabinet ministers. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 vote, ruled yesterday that workers who become ill from exposure to toxic substances on the job may seek damages to pay for fear they will someday develop cancer, even if they never do get the disease. The court's ruling came in a case involving railroad workers afflicted with lung disease called asbestosis, who were fearful about developing cancer. Industry and insurance groups had attempted to persuade the Supreme Court to limit employers' liability for damages from asbestos. Developers of oil and gas sites across the country will have at least 2 more years before they're required to get new stormwater permits intended to protect fish, wildlife, and people. The Environmental Protection Agency has postponed the implementation of the new regulations, which were to go into effect this week. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan announced yesterday that months of intense talks between Greek and Turkish leaders to reunify Cyprus have ended in failure. Federal regulators yesterday blocked a proposal by utility companies to store high-level nuclear waste on an Indian reservation in Utah's western desert, citing dangers posed by a nearby Air Force training range. The Senate appears set to ban certain late-term abortions that have been debated in the Senate since 1995. The current bill provides an exemption from the ban in cases where the procedure is necessary to save a woman's life, but it does not provide an exemption to protect her health. And the San Francisco Chronicle reports that library patrons in Santa Cruz, California, are now being warned that records of the books they borrow may wind up in the hands of federal agents. Last week, the city posted warnings in 10 branches. The signs note that the USA Patriot Act, quote, prohibits library workers from informing you if federal agents have obtained records about you. And patrons are told questions about this policy should be directed to Attorney General John Ashcroft, Department of Justice, Washington, D.C., 20530.
Well, there once was an election by unpopular selection of an imbecilic lion father's son. 'Cause he was next in line to rise up from the slime and take the throne by coup d'etat.
Jolie Rickman, Colleen Kotlow here in our Firehouse studio, live. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. A U.S. military investigation into the deaths of 2 prisoners who are being held for interrogation at the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan by U.S. forces is continuing. Last week, a U.S. military pathologist report concluded the prisoners had been beaten. It's not yet publicly known what else the prisoners endured. Former prisoners say detainees are chained to the ceiling, shackled so tightly the blood flow stops, kept naked and hooded and kicked to keep them awake for days on end. This according to the Guardian of London. This Sunday, the New York Times reported on the interrogation of another prisoner at Bagram Air Base. The U.S. alleges Omar al-Farouk was a senior al-Qaeda operative and Southeast Asia confidant of Osama bin Laden. A Western intelligence official told the Times Farouk's interrogation was, quote, not quite torture, but about as close as you can get. Over a 3-month period, he was fed very little while being subjected to sleep and light deprivation, prolonged isolation, and room temperatures that varied from 10 to 100 degrees. Experts say it is also highly likely his interrogation followed a pattern of other interrogations. Farouk was likely kept naked most of the time with hands and feet bound. International law requires prisoners be allowed 8 hours sleep a day, but interrogators don't let them sleep for 8 consecutive hours. Farouk was questioned in this way for weeks. In the end, U.S. officials claim he began to cooperate. But it appears Farouk is one of the lucky ones. Intelligence officials admit some suspects have been turned over to security services in countries known to employ torture, such as Syria and the staunch U.S. ally, Egypt. U.S. intelligence officials say such interrogation methods are vital to learning information that could help to prevent future attacks on the United States. We're joined right now by Dana Priest, who is a staff writer for The Washington Post. She co-authored a lengthy article published last December called U.S. Decries Abuse But Defends Interrogations, Stress and Duress Tactics Used on Terrorism Suspects Held in Secret Overseas Facilities. The article looks at Army interrogation methods and techniques used at detention centers overseas. We're also joined in our studio by Michael Ratner. He's executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, let's begin with Dana Priest. Can you talk about what you found?
That there were, as you said, stress and duress techniques that in their desperation to get information quickly from a lot of these suspects, that the United States, particularly the CIA, is using methods that, if they were used in the past, we certainly wouldn't have known about them, but which they feel they can use now. No one in Congress or elsewhere has really voiced much opposition to that. That includes setting up their own interrogation centers, in which I don't believe that out-and-out torture that everybody would recognize is taking place, but I think that this sort of much more difficult, as you described in your account just now, sort of shaking people up, making them extremely uncomfortable, depriving them of sleep for certain, in some cases food, of dignity, and others with the being naked a lot, and getting roughed up before they get in there, the whole purpose being to disorient captives before they start to interrogate them so that they are well aware that if they don't cooperate, life is not going to get better. In the cases of mid-level people and probably lower-level hardcore individuals, the CIA is rendering, that is the term, make renditions, they are rendering over some captives to foreign governments whose human rights record and whose known use of torture during interrogations is believed to be used on some of these suspects. And in those cases, what we think is happening is that the CIA maintains some relationship with the interrogation, but it's very arm's length. They're probably not in the room. If they are actually torturing them, I don't even think they're witnessing it outside the room. I think that it's more likely that they're handing the Foreign Intelligence Service a list of questions and saying, you know, come back with the answers, something like that. But I don't think the CIA is directly involved in torture, but they have certainly are turning them over to countries in which they are known to use torture.
Countries like
Morocco, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, in some cases, probably not very many because Syria is not really an ally of the United States. Egypt, you can go on any website for the State Department's Human Rights Annual Reports and find a long history of how Egypt, for example, but the others as well that I mentioned, treat people in detention who they consider to be hostile or suspects, many of them political dissidents, of course, but in this case, they would be suspected terrorists.
You quote one official who was directly involved in rendering captives into foreign hands, saying the understanding is we don't kick the expletive out of them. We send them to other countries so they can kick the expletive out of them.
Right. I don't think that the CIA wants to be, and this is sort of the deniability factor, that itself, it's not going to commit what you and I would clearly recognize as torture. What they do is the stress and duress techniques that involve everything short of that and are meant to break somebody down. Now, I have to say, on the other side, they're often willing to be give people comfort, food, and adequate clothing and water and that sort of thing if they are cooperating, and to pull some tricks on them, including this thing that's called a false flag operation, in which you make somebody believe that there's somebody somewhere that they're not. You make them believe, for instance, that they are in the hands of a foreign government known to torture people, and therefore that they become even more frightened and more willing to give up information. It's a tactic that appears to be working. We don't know, of course, what the cost of that is and how many people who don't have information have undergone this, but we do know that they have been successful in getting a number of high-level and significant al-Qaeda members to cooperate with them and give them information that has then allowed them to make further arrests. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would fall into that category. And certainly he's the most interesting person to watch right now, even though we have no way to really get a good sense of what's going on, because he and a lot of the things they captured in his room in Pakistan are believed to be connected to not just the number of people that they don't know about, but now they may have a good sense of where they are in the United States, but also ongoing operations. And that is their first priority, is to try to stop anything like that.
We're talking to Dana Priest, a Washington Post reporter, who has done an investigative piece along with Barton Gellman called U.S. Decries Abuse But Defends Interrogations, Stress and Duress Tactics Used on Terrorism Suspects Held in Secret Overseas Facilities. How many people have been held in this way, do you know?
Well, we're not certain. We know from public testimony by the CIA Director George Tenet that about 3,000 people have been detained worldwide, and they won't say how many of those have been released, and those aren't detained in U.S. hands. I think you could safely say in the dozens, but whether you could go higher than that is really unclear. The best independent reporting that has been done on this is some of the human rights groups who have tried to track the people who've come out of Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan and have talked about being in prison there. That is just a partial picture, though, because there are two facilities at Bagram. Bagram is the main headquarters for the U.S. military in Afghanistan, and it has a two-story detention center for the military detainees. And that is not what we're talking about. We are talking about, although one could also question, you know, what has happened in those cases, but we're talking about a separate facility in which the CIA controls the interrogations, and it is off limits from the military, and it involves many fewer people. So in reality, we don't have a sense of how many people this campaign has scooped up and what they are doing with them. And of course, governments, foreign and domestic, are not making that information available, nor are they really responding to anybody who's asking to make that information available. And the fact is, not many members of Congress who you think might ask about that are, in fact, asking about that.
You talk about Abu Zubaydah, who is believed to be the most important al-Qaeda member in detention, shot in the groin during his apprehension in Pakistan in March. National security officials suggesting his painkillers were used selectively in the beginning of his captivity, and now he's talking.
Right. Well, there you go. Is that torture? I mean, some people would say it is. Other people would say, well, not technically, but you would get a debate on that. And yes, I think we have confirmed it to our high degree of confidence that that's what happened, that he was shot, so he was in a lot of pain, and the painkillers were given to him selectively. I would say that I think Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is much more important than Abu Zubaydah, again, because of the freshness of his information, his potential communications with bin Laden and others who now make up the top ranks of the active al-Qaeda. And so that is one thing to keep an eye on, whether he's cooperating or not and what kind of treatment. We don't really actually know where he is now, We presume that he's no longer in Pakistan, but that he's been brought overseas to another location where the CIA can operate without any scrutiny.
Dana Priest, I want to thank you for being with us. The Washington Post did an expose on what is happening to the prisoners in U.S. captivity or handed over by the United States to governments that are known to engage in torture, like Morocco, like Jordan, like Syria. And it sounds like, from what you're describing, we can add the United States to that list. We'll get comment on that from the head of Amnesty International and Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us.
I look at the stars tonight like never before. To see such beauty on the eve of war, I think of the children who lay awake to bombs outside their door. And my town idiot calls himself president. You say these children's deaths were unfortunate, but the stakes are human. He says war makes war no more. Fellow American, you know that this war won't be won. You must wrestle your finger from trigger of the gun and come and join hands with the peace-loving nation. Now the price of power is manifold. Your pastures of plenty are being sold, while hard-working people
Jolie Rickman, Colleen Kotlow in our Firehouse studio. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. We're going to continue our discussion about torture. Michael Ratner is with us, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Dr. William Schultz, executive director of Amnesty International USA. Dr. Schultz, let's begin with you, your response to the description.
Well, this is a critically important report, all of these are, and obviously it reflects behavior on the United States that is in violation of the United States' own history, of its own constitution, of its own standards. The U.S. ratified the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment and Punishment in 1994. And virtually every single one of the practices that Dana Priest's story described are ones which the United States has itself denounced in its annual State Department human rights reports in countries around the world, from Saudi Arabia to China to Haiti. If the United States now is practicing these very same things, we not only lose whatever moral authority we may have had to criticize these practices elsewhere, but indeed, if this is a war against terror being fought in the name of defending freedom and the rule of law, we sacrifice any authority we may have had to conduct that war in defense of the rule of law. And we also put in jeopardy every American serviceman and woman around the world, including those who appear to be about to go into war in Iraq, who may themselves fall into the hands of adversaries and who may themselves be subjected to this kind of treatment.
I want to say we had billed this as a debate, but Colonel Roger King, who is the military spokesman at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, has declined to go on. Michael Ratner, your response to the descriptions that we have heard of how prisoners are kept either in U.S. custody or given over to countries that engage in torture.
Well, Dana Priest's report was obviously very important in the Washington Post for all of us. I disagree with her on a couple of things in that report. First of all, she's trying to make some distinction, or the U.S. government is really, that she's quoting, between torture and lesser conduct. In fact, as Bill Schultz just said, there is a conduct that's prohibited called cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, which would include exactly what the United States is doing, having people stand up, keeping them awake for 10-20 hours in a row or 20 hours in a row withholding food. That's illegal. It's contrary to the torture convention. It does border in this case, I think, more than border. I think the U.S. has actually even overstepped that illegality and gone into torture. What we know here is when people are chained up for 16 days out of 20 days, denied food, when they receive beatings, that's clearly torture. If these two people who were killed because of beatings, if that's why they died, that's absolutely clearly torture, illegal completely. In terms of this idea that we're rendering suspects to countries as a way of avoiding ourselves doing torture, that doesn't get us off the hook. The Torture Convention prohibits sending anyone to a country where we have reason to believe they may be tortured. In fact, my own office is now representing an Egyptian man who was sent to Egypt, put into their custodial services, tortured for 3 weeks with electroshocks, finally got out as a result of somebody in the military. That's torture. It's not just Egypt that's guilty. It's the United States that's guilty by rendering a suspect to a country where they have reason to believe that person will be tortured. What's going on here is clearly torture, and if it's not that, it's cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. It's immoral, it's illegal, and it's counterproductive.
What do you mean it's counterproductive?
I mean that it's counterproductive in a number of different senses. First of all, you don't often get reliable information. You have people going all over the world following leads that may make no sense when you torture someone. We know here in the United States, people give confessions all the time that implicate other people that have nothing to do with what actually happened in the crime. Secondly, it's counterproductive in the sense that how do we want U.S. people to be treated when they're captured? Do we want them to be tortured? Thirdly, the people that are released after torture, what does it make out of them? If it hasn't destroyed their lives, it's going to make them into very, very angry people. And fourthly, it's going to make, as knowledge of this comes out, it's going to make people in this world angry that our country, supposedly a cradle of civilization in this regard of outlawing torture, is actually engaging in that practice. It's really off the charts, and people ought to be screaming about it.
Mm-hmm. In a piece in the New York Times, it says, in Cairo, leaders of several human rights organizations and attorneys who represent prisoners said torture by the Egyptian government's internal security force has become routine. They also say they believe that the U.S. has sent a handful of al-Qaeda suspects to Egypt for harsh interrogation and torture by officials. One lawyer said, in the past, the United States harshly criticized Egypt when there were human rights violations, but now for America, it is security first, security before human rights. On the issue of the information that is gotten from a torture victim, recently the Justice Department put the United States on orange alert and then brought it down. But that upping to orange alert, though in New York I think we're still there, I'm not
sure.
That's
correct, we are.
Was based on what?
Well, that's the question. You know, it's the second time we've been put on a higher alert based on evidence that may have been gotten from torture and that turned out to be unreliable. Remember when there were those five suspects who supposedly infiltrated from Canada and there was some guy in some jail somewhere who gave up the information? Unreliable information. That's a good example
to me. In fact, those Pakistani men came forward in Pakistan and said, we never tried to get into the United States. And that became an inside the newspaper story, if the newspapers reported it at all, that these people had nothing to do with anything.
Right. And look at the effects on all of us of that, not just on the immediate effects of everybody being terrified and their children being terrified in the United States, but the canceling of essentially a march through New York because of this orange alert. The whole feeling that this country has to go to war against these people and make war to stop this. All of that is a result of basically information that may well have been obtained through torture that turned out to be false. There is no real shortcut here that can be there's no real shortcut in which torture can be used to somehow stop terrorism. You have to stop terrorism both through good police work as well as getting at the underlying causes of it. If you look at Israel, is Israel safer today because they've tortured hundreds if not thousands of suspects? I don't think so.
William Schultz, what is Amnesty International doing right now about this issue of torture?
Well, it won't surprise you to know that Amnesty, of course, has protested this at the highest levels of the government, is organizing our membership against this. It's not surprising to me that your military spokesperson didn't want to come on this program. In fact, the government has been eerily silent in this respect as they have been challenged. There have been some perfunctory denials, but certainly nothing as strong as one would expect against charges that are so serious. Amnesty has been communicating regularly with President Bush about this. We have not received even the courtesy of a response from an underling in the White House. Human rights directors have been in conversation directly with Assistant Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz and others in the Defense Department about this matter and have not received satisfactory denials or any indication that there would be appropriate investigations. These kind of things need to be not only investigated but exposed and exposed officially, not just in the news media. It is indeed shocking that fewer members of Congress, even those who one would expect would raise this issue, have done so yet. And part of our strategy, of course, is to up the ante with those members of Congress and insist that Congress do its constitutional job of reviewing these types of activities.
The thing we have done, Bill, is we have filed a petition at the Organization of American States Inter-American Human Rights Commission,
Yes. Basically
saying to the United States, come up and tell us what you're doing in Bagram, in Diego Garcia, in other what I would have to now call not just interrogation centers, but unfortunately you might have to call torture centers. Significantly, the Inter-American Commission asked us for more information and is going to want the United States to respond, I think. That is one legal step we've taken. We are also contemplating lawsuits on behalf of either this person in Egypt, people we represent in Bagram, and people we represent in Guantanamo. I'm not saying we're going to win these, but it is important, I think, for the public to understand that our country is basically reaching for the lowest levels that you can reach in terms of the kind of torture it's carrying out on people.
And this, of course, as Michael well knows, is part of a much larger pattern here of denial of basic fundamental rights such as access to counsel that is being perpetrated in the name of national security. And horrific as the torture is, I think it's important to also see it in a larger context of the United States sacrificing literally decades worth of commitment to human rights in the name of protecting us and potentially doing so in a way that, in fact, will make all of our lives more dangerous.
Important point, Bill. I mean, you have 3,000 people out there for over a year, some of them, no counsel, no access to family, totally in the control of the CIA. And that's the first violation right there, is why aren't these people allowed to communicate? Where are their lawyers? What's going on here?
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Michael Ratner, if people want to get in touch with the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The website is ccr-ny.org, ccr-ny.org. Phone number 212-614-6464.
And William Schultz of Amnesty International.
The website is Amnesty USA, one word, amnestyusa.org, or you can call 1-800-AMNESTY.
I want to thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, Amy.
As we move now abroad, the Bush administration has announced it's not going to put forth a plan for a peace settlement between Israel and the Palestinians until after the crisis with Iraq is resolved. New York Times reported yesterday that President Bush does not want to do anything to anger Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, in part because the White House doesn't want him to intervene in the war, even if Israel is attacked by Iraqi missiles. The freeze on the peace process has infuriated allies, including British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who say progress on a peace plan for the Israeli-Palestinian crisis is needed to quell mounting anti-Western sentiment. And on Friday, Foreign Minister of France, Dominique de Villepin, said the absence of peace efforts in the Palestinian-Israeli crisis is a far greater threat to stability than the possibility of weapons in Iraq. This comes at a time when the Palestinian Authority has taken steps to answer international critics. Yesterday, the Palestinian parliament voted overwhelmingly to create a new prime minister post. Mahmoud Abbas has been nominated to be the authority's first prime minister. He'll be second in command to Yasser Arafat. Meanwhile, as the world's attention focuses on Iraq, Israel has cracked down on Gaza. Since February 15th, dozens of Palestinians have been killed. We're going to turn right now to two people to talk about the situation. We'll begin with Michal Warshavsky, who is in an airport and only has a minute to talk. He's just about to board a plane. He's an Israeli policy analyst who is the former director of the Alternative Information Center. Thanks for these few minutes.
Yes.
Can you tell us the latest news you're hearing from Gaza, as well as the Bush administration's statement that it will freeze the peace settlement plans until after the crisis with Iraq is resolved?
In fact, these two developments are very much linked. together the public positions of the American administration is in fact a green light given to the Israeli government to do whatever they want in their policy of pacification of the Palestinian people. And Gaza is a very sad example of how far can this policy of pacification and overall repression, how far can it go and how brutal it can be. As long as the American will continue to say that there is no political settlement on the horizon, the Israeli government, which is the most rightist government ever in the history of Israel, will understand it, and correctly so, as a green light to go on to impose on the Palestinians Sharon's plan.
Mechara Shasky, I know you have to get on that plane, so I thank you for being with us. We are also joined. We are joined also by Justin Hugler, who is in Jabalia, Gaza Strip, and wrote a piece called "Indelible Image of Palestinian Firemen Killed by Shrapnel." Can you talk about what you witnessed?
Well, what I witnessed was the aftermath of an Israeli incursion, in which at the end of the incursion, this fireman and seven other Palestinians were killed. What we found when we went there afterwards is what happened, there was an incursion during the night. These things happen pretty often, where the Israeli tanks go in. They're looking for some Hamas militants they want to capture. They go in, and there's usually some fighting with gunmen, and usually some people killed. Pretty often unarmed civilians get killed in the midst of that. But then what seems to have happened is that as they were leaving, it appears one of the tanks was damaged by some Palestinian explosives. But then somehow a furniture store caught fire. It's not clear whether those explosives set it on fire or something else. Then the firemen came and they were trying to put the blaze out. And there's television footage of what happened next. There's a fireman, two firemen holding onto a fire hose trying to put out a fire. And then a whole lot of shrapnel comes down the street. And it's quite obvious when you slow this film down that this is some form of projectile. All the shrapnel travels in one direction, travels very fast. The Palestinians who were there told us that the Israeli tank at the end of the street fired at the firemen. The Israeli army admits that the tank did fire a shell at that time. It says it opened fire at a Palestinian militant with a rocket-propelled grenade, and that it never fired towards civilians. But what's clear from the film is that the shell travels in the exact direction of the fireman, which means that whoever the tank was firing at, whether it was aiming at a militant or not, it must have fired in the knowledge that the fireman would be hit as well.
I actually saw some of the video when the fireman went to put out the fire and then was shot on network television in the United States, which was very rare. It's rare to see that kind of blood and gore on the networks. Also, a Reuters, I don't know if it was a cameraman reporter who was also hit. Is that right?
Yeah, the shrapnel hit two Reuters journalists. I think one a cameraman and one a photographer.
Yeah, they were in the images as they were. They were in the image in the film I saw as they were trying to escape.
Yeah, they were. One of them was very seriously hurt. He was. Reuters managed to get him transferred to an Israeli hospital, and I think they're saying it's going to be 8 months before he is fully recovered. He has severe injuries to his legs from the shrapnel. I mean, this shrapnel, you know, whatever was fired towards a very large crowd. There were a large crowd of people watching the firemen, as you would have seen from those images. It's not only cameramen. There were a lot of civilians there, because this happened at around 6:30 in the morning when Palestinian children are up, ready to go to school. They all knew that there'd been an incursion. They all knew there was a big fire. Everyone ran out to go and see it. And the other thing that was we could see on the film, I don't know if you saw this, is that even after that incident, gunfire continued coming down the street towards this crowd of civilians for a long time afterwards.
You mentioned that Reuters had the had the Reuters cameraman journalist sent to an Israeli hospital because of how seriously he was wounded. Does that happen with Palestinians as well? What kind of access do they have to health care?
Oh, well, he was a Palestinian, this cameraman, working for Reuters. Palestinians have access if someone will pay the bill, essentially.
He was working, though, for an international organization.
Yeah, yeah. And Reuters is able to pay the bill. Israeli hospitals will take Palestinians who are seriously injured, but someone has to pay for them. Most Palestinians can't afford to pay. So only those who can find someone to foot the bill, generally, are able to do it.
Can you talk about what the media focus on Iraq and the Security Council and the United States means now for Israel and Gaza and the West Bank?
Well, I mean, certainly we've seen a pattern in the last 3 weeks. Of Israel stepping up its offensive, particularly in the Gaza Strip. There's also been operations in Nablus in the West Bank. And there certainly seems to be a correlation to the fact that the world's attention is not focused on Israel and the occupied territories. It's focused on Iraq. And there's less scrutiny of what the Israelis are doing, you know. This is something that a lot of Israelis are pointing out about their own government, but there's less scrutiny of what's going on. The Gaza Strip, particularly in the last 3 weeks, has been a very high level of very violent incursions, you know, incursions in the night by Israeli tanks and helicopters going into the refugee camps and the towns. They say to pick up militants, but really been quite liberal in their use of fire, a lot of firepower being used. After one, I found a hole in the living room of someone's house and the remains of a tank shell beneath it, where they'd fired a tank shell at a house. And a lot of civilians are being killed in these operations. I also went to the house where a pregnant woman was killed, a 9 months pregnant woman, who basically the Israeli army had demolished the house next door. This is a policy that they have towards the homes of the families of suicide bombers. They say it discourages future suicide bombers. International Human Rights Group say this is collective punishment and against the Geneva Conventions. But they demolished this house. They'd evacuated the people from the house. They'd evacuated the people from the houses on either side, but they forgot to evacuate the houses which backed onto the house. They ordered everyone except those they'd specifically evacuated to stay inside. So this woman was trapped in her house, which backed on the house they were demolishing. When they dynamited it, the wall fell on her and she was crushed to death.
Justin Hugler is reporting to us from Gaza and has been doing a series of pieces for the Independent of Britain. What about this idea that Bush is trying to appease Sharon so that he will not attack Iraq if Iraq hits them with missiles?
Well, I wouldn't really. I'm not sure to what extent I comment on what Mr. Bush's motives are. There certainly seems to be an absence of any pressure from the U.S. on the Israelis for restraint in the occupied territories at the moment. There doesn't seem to be anybody leaning on them not to keep up these constant incursions. There's not much pressure for them to relieve the extraordinary degree of suffering of civilians in places like the Gaza Strip. Why Mr. Bush doesn't want to do that, it's beyond me to say.
You describe in the piece that you wrote about the Palestinian fireman who went to put out the fire and then was hit by a burst of shrapnel and crumpled to the ground. You talked about the kind of ammunition that the Israeli tank fired, the shell packed with flechettes. Can you describe that?
Well, I should say, I said that Palestinians there had said that they used a shell packed with flechettes. I don't know with certainty in that instance that they did. We do know that they use those kind of shells in the Gaza Strip, that they have done in the past, so it would not be surprising if they did. I mean, these shells are basically packed with these tiny flechettes, which are little arrow-shaped bits of steel. When the shell hits the ground, it breaks open, and these fly everywhere. They're basically designed to inflict mass casualties, to affect as many people as possible.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. We will certainly continue to follow this story. Justin Hugler is with the British newspaper The Independent, and he has been reporting from Gaza Strip. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a man is set to be executed 6 o'clock Texas time on Wednesday. He will be the 300th person to die in the electric chair in Texas since the death penalty was reinstated. His lawyers say this is one of the best cases for innocence that they have seen. We'll hear from the man himself, his mother, and his lawyer. Stay with us.
We want peace in this land, New Jerusalem. We want peace in this land, New Jerusalem. We want peace in this land, New Jerusalem. Daer HaKibush, New Jerusalem. Now they want to send my girl to Bahrain. Equality ties to that ball and that chain.
You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is the War and Peace Report. Yesterday, New York Times columnist Bob Herbert wrote a column titled Countdown to Execution Number 300, Does the Truth Matter in Texas? It chronicled the case of Delma Banks, Jr., a man from Texas who's expected to be executed tomorrow night. The article begins, "The war trumps all other issues, so insufficient attention will be paid to the planned demise of Delma Banks Jr., a 43-year-old man who is scheduled in about 48 hours to become the 300th person executed in Texas since the resumption of capital punishment in 1982. Mr. Banks, a man with no prior criminal record, is most likely innocent of the charge that put him on death row. Fearing a tragic miscarriage of justice, three former federal judges, including William Sessions, a former director of the FBI, have urged the U.S. Supreme Court to block Wednesday's execution. So far, no one seems to be listening." Well, today we're joined by Delma's mother, as well as a member of his legal defense team. But we're going to start off by hearing from Delma Banks Jr. himself. This was recorded last week on death row.
So when I first got a date, I thought they were going to execute me. And I thought it was over, so I was pushing everybody away, you know, figuring that if they weren't so close to me, it wouldn't hurt as much. Wouldn't write nobody. Just trying to get everybody out of my life, thinking in my twisted mind that the further away from me, you know, the less it'll hurt. But my mom would let it go. She kept writing me and she kept insisting. She'd tell me, she said, "Look, if you ain't got nothing to say, just write and tell me you ain't got nothing to say." And she'd been at it for 20-some years. It finally got through. She the only one I couldn't push away. Just tell her I said I love her and tell her I said thanks for being my mom.
Delma Banks Jr., speaking from death row. Aline Banks is Delma Banks' mother, speaking to us from Texas. Welcome to Democracy Now! Ms. Banks, are you there?
Yes.
Can you talk about your son's case in this last 30 hours that you have to try to get a stay of his execution?
Yes. I'm Eileen Banks. I'm the mother of Delma Banks, Jr. My son is supposed to be executed tomorrow, and it is just breaking my heart because nothing has linked him with this murder. The murder weapon was not my son's. The murder weapon was a 25 and them on a 22. No ballistic report. The car that he was supposed to have been driven has never been found as of this date. And it was an old car having alternator trouble. The time of death was later than the state said it was. They convicted him on a paid informer information, Robert Farr, and Charles Cook, who was two convicted felony. They took their words against my son, who has never been in trouble before. And later, these two people admitted that they lied, that they was pressured by the police. They were drilled. Charles Cook was drilled for 3 days, and he was threatened to say just what the police told him to say, unless if he didn't, he was going back to prison, and he didn't want to do that. And he told me, he came to me the day of the court. We had a hearing in Texarkana. He stated, said, "Miss Banks, I come to tell the truth. I've been living with this life for so many years, and I have turned my life around. I'm a minister now, and I want to tell the truth. The things that I said against Delma was a lie. I was afraid of going back to prison." And I can't understand why they just convicted my son on circumstantial evidence, no eyewitness. The gun, like I said, wasn't his, and the car that he was supposed to have stolen has never been found. And I even mentioned myself, if my son drove the car, his fingerprints is there on the car somewhere. I said, why can't you bring the car forward? That's evidence, you know. And they said they didn't have to. And, you know, a person is innocent until they are proven guilty without a reasonable doubt. And the burden of proof was on the state shoulder, and they haven't proven it. And I hate to see my son go down for a murder he didn't commit, and I'm just hoping and praying that the Supreme Court will come forward and save my son.
Eileen Banks, mother of Delma Banks. Now the major newspapers are writing about his case in these last hours. The Washington Post of yesterday says the evidence that Delma Banks Jr. was guilty of murder was limited from the start. No fingerprints, no witnesses to the crime, little apparent motive. Nonetheless, in a one-day trial in 1980, an all-white Texas jury convicted Banks, a young black man, of killing a white teenager, and the next day he was sentenced to death. Now 23 years, 15 death warrants, and a half dozen appeals after the crime, Banks is scheduled to be executed by lethal injection on Wednesday, even though the key witness against him has recanted parts of his testimony and evidence of prosecutorial misconduct has emerged. The case attracting the attention of former FBI Director William Sessions, who joined by two federal retired appeals court judges and a top former federal prosecutor, has asked the Supreme Court to stay Banks' execution. Miriam Gahara is with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Can you tell us what are the chances of this stay are?
We're optimistic that the court will recognize that no substantive review, particularly by the state courts of Texas, have considered the evidence which the prosecution has suppressed. The prosecution sat for years and decades on evidence that the two key witnesses against Mr. Banks, one, Charles Cook going to his guilt, as Ms. Banks mentioned, and second, Robert Farr going to the issue of his future dangerousness, were both had strong incentives to lie. One of them was a paid informant. They were both hardcore drug addicts, and none of this information was provided to defense counsel in order to allow Mr. Banks' counsel to properly impeach and cross-examine them. As a result of that, this evidence never came out until the federal court review process, which was almost 20 years after this crime was committed. All throughout the state proceedings, direct review, and state post-conviction, the state suppressed this evidence. Only when the federal court looked at it did it entirely come to light how deceptive and entirely untrue not only the testimony but the prosecutors had been in this case. So we're optimistic that the Supreme Court will see that no state review as of yesterday, when the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals denied our last-minute application for review in that court, has considered this strong evidence, which not only points to Mr. Banks' innocence, but seriously undermines the confidence in the administration of the death penalty in Texas and nationally.
In the case of Delma Banks, his lawyer, what was he like?
Delma, the lawyer who has been representing Delma for 15 years, George Kendall, is en route to Texas now to meet with him. I've never met Delma in person. I've worked on his case intermittently now for about 5 years. And
his original lawyer.
His original lawyer. Oh, I'm sorry. You're asking about the original trial court lawyer? The original trial court lawyer was actually the former district attorney of Bowie County, Texas, and had been up until very close to the time that Delma was tried. He had gone into private practice as a defense lawyer and admitted repeatedly at the trial that he was not prepared for the case and that he had not been provided with key information that he needed to cross-examine the witnesses. Even more significant, I think, is that Delma at one point pointed out to his lawyer that all of the jurors who were being chosen were white, and he asked that African Americans be put on his jury. This former district attorney, who was well acquainted with the processes that were in place at the district attorney's office in Bowie County, wrote Delma a note back that said, they will strike all blacks. In other words, he knew that there was no chance that Delma was going to have a mixed-race jury. And in a case such as Delma's, where the victim was white and Delma was African-American, a mixed-race jury could have made all the difference in the world between life and death.
Is there anything people can do?
We are urging that people call Governor Rick Perry of Texas. His phone number is 512-460-2000. We're asking that they ask Governor Perry to grant a 30-day reprieve to Delma. He has the power and authority to do that, and it may give us an opportunity to further pursue further appeals.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We have been speaking with Miriam Gohara, NAACP Legal Defense Fund lawyer, part of the legal team for Delma Banks Jr., who is scheduled to be executed tomorrow at 6 p.m. Texas time, unless the Supreme Court stays that execution. Eileen Banks, mother of Delma Banks, on the line with us from Texas. I want to thank you both for being with us. If people want to get a copy of today's show, they can call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800, rather, they can call 1-800-881-2359. The program has been expanded to 2 hours. Some stations are adjusting their schedules to accommodate this. This is due to popular demand. Also want to encourage people to check out Charlie Rose tonight, or it might be tomorrow night. I just taped an interview with him about the war and about media coverage of it. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Elizabeth Press also helped today. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Helicopters will escort you up to your towering towers of Donald Trump, and you'll put your nickel in the blind man's cup. Hide the rest in your offshore trust, and you close your eyes and you lock the doors, and you run until your feet go sore as America.